It's 12 o'clock by my time, so I think we would start. There are still people joining, but good afternoon and welcome to the Iowa City Foreign Relations Council's program featuring guest speaker Kerry Schuerspeld. Thanks to Professor Schuerspeld and to everyone who has joined us in person and online. My name is Sunday Goshit, and I'm an Iowa City Foreign Relations Council's board member and co-chair of the program committee. Iowa City Foreign Relations Council wants to acknowledge and thank its annual donors, members, sponsors, and partners for their support. This list includes the Iowa Arts Council through the Iowa Department of Cultural Affairs, Humanities Iowa, and the National Endowment for the Humanities, the University of Iowa's International Programs, Honors Program, and Public Policy Center, the Stanley UI Foundation Support Organization, Midwest One Bank, Taxes Plus, City Channel 4 for providing online access to ICFRC's programs along with the UI Library Archives. ICFRC has adopted the Native American land acknowledgement prepared for the City of Iowa City's Ad Hoc Truth and Reconciliation Commission and the Human Rights Commission. ICFRC recognizes that our home community of Iowa City now occupies the homeland of Native American nations to whom we owe our commitment and dedication. And the full text of ICRFC's acknowledgement is on its website at icrfc.org. As we get started, I'd like to cover some Zoom etiquette tips. This is the time to make sure you know where your video and audio mute and unmute buttons are located. You're already muted, so we ask you to please keep your audio and video turned off for the duration of the presentation, so you do not disturb the speaker. Following our speaker's presentation, at about 12:45 p.m., we will have a 15-minute question and answer. You will also be able to submit your questions via the chat function. At that time, we invite you to turn on your video, but please keep your audio muted to avoid any background noise. At this point, I would like to introduce Professor Schuerspeld. Sorry, I'm sorry. I have problem pronouncing. Kerry, can you forgive me, please?
Of course. You might imagine, Sunday, that this is not the first time that someone has struggled with my last name. Yes. Thank you so much, Sunday, and the Iowa City Foreign Relations Council. So my name is Kerry Schuerspeld, and I am an associate professor in the School of Planning and Public Affairs at the University of Iowa. I'm also a senior fellow in the Public Policy Center. I am an enrolled member of the Lumbee Tribe of North Carolina, and I currently am working on a book that is under contract with Flatiron Books, titled The Indian Card. So I'm excited to be here and tell you a little bit about what I'm thinking about and researching. And again, thank you so much to the Iowa City Foreign Relations Council. I am going, Sunday, if you give me the go-ahead, I'm going to go ahead and share my screen and get started, if that's okay.
Yes, please go ahead.
Okay. So I have some slides that I'll talk a little bit about, and then we can do questions if folks have some. So let me just make sure that my slides are ready to go. Here we go. All right, Sunday, can you see that?
Yes.
Okay, perfect. So I will assume that everyone can see that. So again, my name is Kerry Schuerspeld. the book that I'm working on is called The Indian Card. And so today I'm going to just talk to you a little bit about my research and my data set. And then again, certainly open it up to questions. If at any point you can't see the slides or something goes amiss, please just raise your voice and let me know because I cannot see you. I have minimized that screen. So to start, I want to just present a few facts. About 15 years ago, while I was in graduate school at Harvard, I wrote a paper for Bob Putnam's class on social capital. And my paper was about the social capital of Native communities. And in doing that paper and in conducting that research, I started to notice some really interesting data points. And since then, I've kept an eye on these trends, on these data trends, and things have gotten really interesting in the data. And so that really has been the jumping off point for my research and for this book. And so I really just want to start there. So you may recognize this. Probably you have completed a census at some point. If you have completed a census, you'll recognize this question, question 7, which is, what is your race? In 2000, 4.1 million people checked this box here, the third box down, which is American Indian or Alaskan Native. So when asked to self-identify their race, about 4.1 million people checked this box. That in and of itself is not that interesting, right? But when we look at the trends, that's where things start to get fascinating. In 2010, about 5.2 million people checked this box. So, you know, a little bit of an increase, still, you know, although a sizable increase, not that interesting. Here's where things get really, really interesting. In 2020, 9.7 million people self-identified as American Indian or Alaskan Native. That's over double the amount of people who check that box in 2000. I can tell you that no amount of births or deaths or a sudden parachuting of new humans onto this earth can explain this astronomical increase. But there was another data point that piqued my interest and really formed the basis of my research. Of those 9.7 million people who self-identified as Native, only about 2 million people are members of a Native tribe. That's about 20%. Through my data analysis, I've also discovered another really interesting statistic. This one is sort of hot off the presses. You're looking at data that is only about 2 days old. And so while I'm scrubbing it, I feel pretty confident in telling you that of the 5.2 million people who checked the Native American box in 2010, only about 68% wrote in a tribe. So if you're completing the census, a few of these race categories ask you to write something in. The American Indian or Alaskan Native box is one of those. You are instructed to write the name of your enrolled or principal tribe. Over 30% of people did not write anything. We certainly can't assume the reasoning here, but I am very interested in this gap. I'm interested in the gap of people claiming Native identity, but not affiliating with any particular tribe. And to me, this really is the heart of my book project, the idea of enrollment. So the concept of enrollment might be new to you. Indeed, Native people are the only people in this country who must carry a card to prove their racial identity. Essentially, enrollment is the process by which Native people become formalized members of their tribe. And because most people have never seen one of these cards, I've provided some examples here. You'll see that, you know, they're all different, but most are about wallet size. They're mostly plastic or laminated. They sort of resemble a driver's license. So what you'll see over here on the right are three different tribes membership cards. They all have a little bit of a different formatting and a little bit of different information. Now, some might say that Native people have these cards because of the political identity that enrollment comes with, which I think is partially true. But I have found myself more interested in the idea of identity more broadly. And so, in other words, what does it mean that Native people have this additional hurdle of membership to clear in order to prove themselves as Indian? There's a great quote from a TV show I'm pretty sure no one has ever seen but me, although it is available on Netflix. It's called Longmire. The US government only quantifies three things by blood: dogs, horses, and Indians. And it turns out it's true. So in addition to the idea of tribal membership, there's also this other thing that exists, this other hurdle that Native people must clear, which is called the Certificate of Degree of Blood Quantum, often called a CDIB. And that is processed by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And so this is an example of what that card looks like. As you can see, it has the person's name, their birth date, their degree of Indian blood, which is important. So just sort of park that in your brain. And then the principal tribe that they belong to. The CDIB is used for everything from job applications to education applications to scholarships to benefits. Friends who I know who have a CDIB have had to show them when they were applying to, for example, Native-based scholarships for college. I have friends who use them to access benefits from the Indian Health Service. A lot of tribes require that you have a CDIB before they'll even let you enroll in their tribe. I can tell you that I don't have a CDIB and I don't qualify for one because my tribe, the Lumbee Tribe of North Carolina, is not federally recognized. But this generally is a card that most Native people who are affiliated with a tribe knows exists. And yes, Native people, as you can see here, are the only people who must prove how much Native blood they have in order to be bestowed with a federal ID. So how do people go about this process of becoming tribally enrolled? I thought it might be helpful for us to look at an example, assuming that many people here today and really just many people have never experienced this process. The Cherokee Nation really embodies this phenomenon, and so that's the example that I'm using today. This gap between self-identified and enrolled members can really be seen within the Cherokee tribe. Indeed, more Americans claim descent from at least one Cherokee ancestor than any Native American group in the country. In 2000, the federal census reported that 729,533 Americans self-identified as Cherokee. By 2010, that number had increased to 819,105. That may not strike you as an astronomical rise given what we saw earlier, but I can tell you that it is quite steep. Also note that we don't have 2020 data yet. As you might imagine, write-in questions on the census are very time-consuming to compile because there are millions of entries. And so the US Census expects to have 2020 data this year at some point. So this in and of itself is interesting, right? Cherokee, although not the largest tribe in the country, is the tribe that has the most Americans who are claiming, who are self-identifying. Here's though where things get more interesting to me and sort of back to this idea of my book and about Native identity. Only about 370,000 people are enrolled Cherokee citizen nations. That means that of the people who identify as Cherokee, less than half are enrolled in the tribe. So let's look a little bit at what it takes to enroll. So you've determined that you have Cherokee ancestry and you're interested in becoming a Cherokee Nation citizen. What the Constitution of Cherokee Nation says, and I should mention that this constitution was last revised in 1999, is that all citizens of the Cherokee Nation must be original enrollees or descendants of original enrollees listed on the Dawes Rolls. As the Dawes Rolls were created in the first decade of the 20th century, I'll go out on a limb to say that there are no original enrollees left. And so that means that anyone today who is living today must be able to prove that they are a descendant of an original enrollee on the Dawes Rolls. So I've used a historical term. And so now is the time that we have must have a little bit of a historical interlude. So I want to mention that I am not a historian by trade or training, but as part of this book project, I've undertaken a significant amount of research, both archival, primary source research, as well as a lot of secondary research, talking to other scholars and that sort of thing. And here's what I can tell you about the Dawes Rolls that we just saw mentioned in the Cherokee Constitution. The Dawes Rolls were part of a larger U.S. federal government effort called the Dawes Act. You may remember this act from, I don't know if you learned about this in school. I do not recall learning about this in school. The Dawes Act is the more colloquial term for the General Allotment Act. It was passed in 1887, and it essentially broke up reservation land and allotted parcels to individual Native people. It's largely considered to be one of the biggest failures of U.S. policy in Indian country, and there were a lot of sort of negative consequences of this act, including it's estimated that over 90 million acres of Native land were stolen through this process, mostly sold off to non-Native people, which is sort of what this advertisement is here in this flyer. This flyer is from about circa 1910, as you can see, advertising Native land that was once part of a tribal community. So it once belonged to a tribal community. The government came in, took possession of it, allotted plots to Native people. When they ran out of individual people to allot plots to, they took ownership of the rest of the land and sold it off to non-Native, mostly white people. In 1898, the U.S. government took this process a step further. And so what they did was they passed the Curtis Act, which gave the federal government the power to create the rolls of who was considered Indian, ostensibly for the purposes of allotting these plots of land, but this really was a huge shift in federal policy. What had once been sort of the purview of Native tribes, which is defining their own membership, was now transitioned into being something that the federal government could determine. And so this was really a huge turning point in U.S. relations with Indian country. If you read through the Curtis Act, you'll notice something that becomes very, very, very important later on. It's buried deep in federal government language, but you may notice here a reference to blood. This is the first reference. So again, this is 1898, the Curtis Act, and this becomes very important for the future of Native identity and Native membership. This is really the beginning of the U.S. federal government adjudicating who is and who is not Native using blood, quote unquote, as the main determinant. Now, what you might notice, and I'm going to back up so we don't have, so you can sort of look at it cleanly. What you might notice is this is actually pretty vague language. Yes, the word blood is in here, but I'll just read through this statement. Said commission, and so what they're referring to here is the Dawes Commission, part of the Dawes Act, is authorized and directed to make correct rolls of the citizens by blood of all other tribes, eliminating from the tribal rolls such names as may have been placed thereon by fraud or without authority of law, enrolling only as may have lawful right thereto. So this is actually pretty vague language. Essentially, the commission is given all powers and authorities to determine who is and is not native and a member of each tribe. So with this added power, the federal government began the process of enrolling native people. This is a Dawes Rolls card from the Cherokee Nation dated July 17th, 1900. You can sort of see the stamp down in the lower right corner. I hope you can see this. I know that it's a little bit small and the print is a little bit hard to read. But what's important here is that this really was the mechanism that the government used to enroll people into the different tribes. Initially, as written, the Dawes Act did not actually extend to Cherokee Nation or the other so-called five civilized tribes, because Oklahoma at that point was Indian territory and was considered off limits to the U.S. government. They had their own treaties that governed everything that was happening there. With a few amendments to the Dawes Act, and then the subsequent Curtis Act, the government actually extended their power of both land allotment and tribal enrollment to include the five civilized tribes. And so suddenly Cherokee Nation, Choctaw, Chickasaw, those other tribes, they were part of this as well. And this was seen by the US government as a huge victory, because suddenly they had access to what was formerly off limits Oklahoma. Oklahoma statehood then sort of happened subsequently and largely as a result of this. And so what you'll see here is the person's name over here on the left, and then people were instructed to write. So you'd have the head of a household filling out this card, presumably, and then listing all of the other people in their family, their age, their sex, and yes, their blood quantum. This really is the first formalized use of blood quantum. So we saw this in the Curtis Act enumerated in a pretty vague way. This is where it becomes reality. This is where it really becomes affected. And so as people were proceeding to complete these cards, they were required to write down their blood quantum. Blood quantum, I just want to have a little bit of a sidebar here. Blood quantum is a very controversial topic in Indian country, but I can say with certainty that it is absolutely not a creation of Native people. But rather it was a way that the US federal government measured people. So presumably when people were faced with this question as they enrolled, this was probably a new thing for them. They had never conceived of their identity in this way. And so it's probably not it's probably not inaccurate to assume that this wasn't a super precise and accurate way of measuring people. Also, in a lot of instances, blood quantum was actually used against Native people, whether it was to prevent them from getting U.S. citizenship, to keep them from their land allotments, or putting land in very lengthy trusts. There were later amendments to these acts that gave blood quantum measurements. And so if you were more than one half Indian, for example, your land was put into a longer trust period than if you were under one half Indian. So as you might imagine, there were quite a few reverse incentives for people to undercount how Native, quote unquote, they actually were. This becomes important later. So just keep that in mind that we have this column. This is from 1900. I should also mention that if you have an ancestry.com membership, you can actually access these documents pretty easily. All of the Dawes Rolls are uploaded and digitized to ancestry.com. So let's get back to our original example from the Cherokee Nation for a moment. So if you remember, in order to enroll in the Cherokee Nation, you must be a descendant of an original enrollee on the Dawes rolls. Now we know what those are, we know what those look like. And so what's important to remember here is that after almost 125 years, the Dawes rolls are still being implemented, still being used to determine Native identity. And not just for Cherokee, I should mention, many, many tribes across the country are still using these rolls as the basis for who can and cannot enroll. Here is what the actual enrollment application looks like for Cherokee. And again, if it seems like I'm picking on Cherokee, I'm not. I am simply using them as an example because more Americans self-identify as Cherokee than any other tribe. And so it's a good example for us to look at. Also, they very specifically use the Dawes rolls. And so it kind of connects back to that historical example. What's notable here on this application is that you have to provide information, including a roll number for every family member going back to the Dawes rolls. I should also mention that when we said that you had to be a descendant of a Dawes enrollee, that is a direct descendant. So you must be able to connect yourself via parents, grandparents, great-grandparents, et cetera, to someone who is on the Dawes rolls. And so what you'll see here is you're asked to provide your parents' information, your grandparents' information, great-grandparents, et cetera, until you can connect back to someone who would have had a card that looked like this. So these were some of the fact patterns and the original qualitative research that I conducted and continue to conduct for my book. But in my heart, I'm sort of a data nerd. And so what has become important to me in telling this story and in connecting all of these dots through historical research and current sort of facts is to be able to see how these issues around enrollment are playing out in Indian country. And so the rest of this presentation is going to focus on my original quantitative research. I should say now that I've had some really fantastic research assistants over the years, including Acacia Roberts, Andrew Parr, and Clara Tang, who have helped me compile just umpteen data sets, compiling them into one data set and trying to find lots of needles in lots of haystacks. And so I'm very grateful to them for their assistance. So in analyzing every federally recognized tribe in the contiguous United States, what I discovered is that there are really just two ways that tribes determine eligibility. There's blood quantum, which we've talked a little bit about, and there's lineage, which we've sort of also talked a little bit about. I want to just pause here and say that my research is really focused on the 48 contiguous United States. Alaska, for anyone who has been there or done research on Alaska Native communities, knows that they are very different and they deserve their own special, analyses. And so that is beyond the scope of my particular research. So as we sort of deep dive into the data, let's start with blood quantum. Simply put, blood quantum is the amount of Native, quote, blood that a person can claim. Now, I, of course, need a disclaimer here, and you see that I've put blood with quotations, and that's because, as I said before, blood quantum is very controversial. It is not a Native practice. It was a practice that was imposed upon Native communities by the federal government. And so there has been a lot of discussion in the research and by scholars and Native communities around what it means. What does blood quantum mean? If you're interested in reading more about that, there have been a lot of fantastic researchers who have written about Native blood quantum, including Kim Tallbear, whose recent book, Native American DNA, is a personal favorite of mine and certainly a good starting point if you're particularly interested in thinking about Native blood quantum. So in this example, this is just a very simplified example. So if you have a person who has 4/4 native blood quantum, and they have children with a person who has 0 native blood quantum, their children would have half blood quantum. And then on up the line, if we assume that each subsequent generation has children with a person who is not native. And so in 3 generations, you've gone from 4/4 blood quantum to 1/8 blood quantum. This is a really important example and distinction, as we'll see later when we look at the ways that different tribes measure who can and can't enroll. In my research, I've estimated and I found that about 176 out of the 358 federally recognized tribes in the 48 contiguous United States use some form of blood quantum to determine enrollment. So about 49% of all tribes take blood quantum into account when making enrollment and membership decisions. Tribes that use blood quantum typically do so in one of 3 ways. And so the most common way is 1/4 blood quantum. So if you do a scan of all of the tribes in the country, which we have done, you'll see that of the tribes that use blood quantum, about 104 are using 1/4 blood quantum as their minimum that you would need to enroll in the tribe. The next most common would be 1/16. About 38 of the tribes that use blood quantum, or 22%, use that. And then the least common is 1/2 or 2/4. About 15 tribes, or 9% of the tribes, use that number. Notably, no tribe in the country, or at least that we've come across, uses 4/4. So there are no tribes that require 4/4 blood quantum in order to enroll. A couple of things that are noteworthy and that I'll just sort of say here is that almost every tribe, with maybe 1 or 2 exceptions, is only using its own tribe for these numbers. What do I mean by that? Well, if you are someone who has ancestry from several different tribes, in order to enroll in one of those tribes, your blood quantum has to be from that tribe exclusively. And so in order to enroll in the Navajo Nation, for example, you need 1/4 Navajo blood quantum. As you might imagine, that becomes problematic for people who have maybe part of their 1/4 blood quantum is Navajo, part is something else. They are not eligible then to enroll in the Navajo Nation. And that's just one example. Another thing that becomes really interesting, sort of as a consequence of all of this, is the idea of what some people call the urban Indian. So it's estimated that almost 80% of Native people live in urban areas. And as more Native people have children with non-Native people or people from other tribes, you might imagine that these blood quantum numbers start to become real barriers to people enrolling in a particular tribe. So that is certainly one thing that I'm looking a lot at as I think about Native identity and the consequences for how we define it. Of the tribes that use blood quantum, these are the 4 largest. So I already used Navajo as one of my examples. Navajo is actually the largest tribe in the country right now. They have just over 400,000 members. I can tell you that this was a big deal when they surpassed Cherokee during COVID. And so Navajo now stands as the largest tribe. Their blood quantum requirement is 1/4, as we mentioned before. The Muskogee tribe, which has about 86,000 members, also uses 1/4. Minnesota Chippewa, right up north, about 41,000 members, also uses 1/4. And then Tohono O'odham, at 28,000 members, is one of those interesting examples of a tribe that's using 1/2 blood quantum as a requirement for enrollment. So these really are the largest tribes that are using blood quantum. The second way that tribes determine membership or enrollment is lineage. And so lineage really is the tracing of yourself through direct ancestors. So again, parents, grandparents, et cetera, to connect to a historical tribal role. So this was our Cherokee example. This is going through genealogy and going through history and looking for a direct descendant who would have appeared on whatever role the tribe is using for enrollment purposes. Based on my data set, I estimate that about 268 of the 358 federally recognized tribes are using lineage to determine membership. That's about 75%. You're saying, but wait, I thought blood quantum was 50%. Your numbers don't add up. Well, that's when we start to see tribes that are actually using both. And so there are tribes that use a combination of blood quantum and lineage to determine membership and enrollment. But by quite a significant amount, lineage is actually the more common system that tribes are using. Of the tribes that are using lineage to determine enrollment, they typically do so in the following ways. So we already looked at the Dawes rolls. Many tribes are still using the Dawes rolls. Again, they were government-led rolls that were created for land allotment purposes. Generally, the Dawes rolls are from 1900 to 1910, although we do see some tribes that are not part of the five civilized tribes who would have had rolls created for them prior to 1900. Another very common thing about tribes that use lineage is that the rolls were created by the tribe or through the U.S. Census. And so particularly tribes that have scrapped the Dawes rolls and are using something else, they're generally using a tribal census that they themselves have conducted. My tribe, the Lumbee Tribe of North Carolina, is an interesting example of a tribe that uses census data. And so if you can connect yourself through a direct descendant to someone who's on the 1900 census, who was listed as native in a particular county in North Carolina, that becomes the basis for the lineage determination for the Lumbee tribe. Another sort of common pattern that we see across tribes that are using lineage is that a lot of the tribal rolls are from the 1930s, and that's because of other U.S. Legislation that came about that required tribes to enact census counts and other measurement counts in order to get federal funding. And so a lot of the tribes that we see that are using lineage are doing so based on the roles that they were required to create by the U.S. government in the 30s. So the four biggest tribes that are using lineage, we already talked about the Cherokee tribe. So Cherokee at 370,000 members is using the Dawes rolls. The Choctaw tribe at about 200,000 members is using 2006 tribal rolls. This is interesting and somewhat unique. Their rolls are very new relative to other tribes. The Ogallala Lakota, with about 47,000 members, is using the 1935 tribal rolls. So again, one of those examples of a tribe using rolls from about that period. And then the Chickasaw tribe, with about 37,000 members, is using 1906 tribal rolls. So these are really the largest tribes that use a lineage system for membership. So in terms of where to go next or where I'm headed next and thinking about this data and the research and sort of the historical fact pattern, there are a few sort of themes that are emerging for me and connect to a lot of the current contemporary discussions that are happening in Indian country. One is the so-called land back movement. And so if we really consider the fact that a lot of this identity politics and a lot of the enrollment process began as a way to strip Native people of their land, there has been a real movement across the country to give land back. It hasn't happened widespread yet. And in fact, when you see tribes that are able to purchase land that was once theirs, almost always they're using their own money or they're getting significant help from grant makers. And so the land back movement is really, instead of having to pay for it themselves, these tribes should be given land that was once theirs that was then stolen through the Dawes Act process. If you're interested in reading more, there's a fantastic article from The Atlantic by the native scholar David Troyer, all about the national parks and thinking about who owns the national parks. Another sort of theme that I've been thinking a lot about, and I mentioned earlier, is the rise of so-called urban Indians. And so what happens as people are moving away from tribal communities, whether a reservation or a settlement or otherwise, and moving into big city centers, having children with non-native people or people from other tribes, what happens then? What is the consequence for Native identity and Native enrollment? We've already seen the ways that tribes measure membership. And so if fewer and fewer people are clearing those hurdles, what is eventually going to happen? And then the third theme really is around identity policing. I think we can probably all think of a few particularly recent examples of people who claim Native identity, but then who are objectively proven to be frauds. I think that is becoming a really important conversation that's happening in Native communities around who gets to claim Native identity. I try to err on the side of not policing identity because I think that's something that Native people have experienced for too long. But there is this interesting dichotomy of thinking about people who claim Native identity but really have no objective connections to it and people who are on the other side of that. So those really are the things that I've been thinking a lot about as I continue with my own research. So again, I want to say thank you to the Iowa City Foreign Relations Council. Thank you to all of you for listening. I'm going to stop sharing my slides, and I think I will turn it back over to Sunday and open it to questions if people have questions.
Yes. Thank you so much, Carrie, for the excellent presentation. We now move forward to the question and answer portion of our program. And I think I've seen a number of questions in the chat function. And feel free to turn on your video if you're posting any more questions. And while we're waiting to answer the questions, I would like to say that ICRFC wants to thank its members and donors for their support. If you'd like to join ICFRC and make a gift to support its programs, please go to our website, ICRFRC.org. Thank you, and we would go to, I think there are a number of questions there, Kerry. The first one there is, for Black people, the blood standard was one drop. What's the standard for Native people?
That's a great question, and one that I myself have tried to figure out based on the legislation and the amendments that were made. As we saw with the language from the Curtis Act, it's very vague. And so I think that often the federal government was able to determine their measure based on what was convenient for their purposes, right? And so if they wanted to really limit Native people's ability to own land, like I said earlier, they put them in these really lengthy trusts. And so just to give you an idea of that, during the Homestead Act, which happened in the 1860s, which was really the precursor to the Dawes Act, homesteaders, mostly white homesteaders, were given their parcels of land, and it was put into a five-year trust. After 5 years, they would own the land outright. When Native people were given their land allotments, it was put into a 25-year trust. And so only after 25 years could they actually own the land outright. And then there were further stipulations, if you really read through the legislation and the amendments, that gave the government the full authority to say, well, if we don't agree with what the Native people have done to the land, we can extend the trust. But never in those documents was there a quantity. So it wasn't that you had to be one quarter or one half in order to have those stipulations. I think that was probably, again, out of convenience for the government to be able to control the policies in the way that they wanted to.
Yeah. Thank you. And that question was from Robin. I don't know if you have any follow-up, but the second one here is more of a comment, but I don't know if you have any comments on that. A childhood friend married a person who was identified as 132 Cherokee. She got obstetric care at Indian Health Care Service in Oklahoma. This was before DNA genetic testing. So it was more of a comment, but I don't know if...
I mean, that makes sense, right? So we just saw that the Cherokee tribe doesn't use a blood quantum measurement. They use lineage. And so if that person was able to trace themselves back to an original Dawes enrollee, I do want to note the DNA element of your question, though, because this is becoming a really common and popular thing that people are talking about. There is no tribe that accepts a DNA result for tribal enrollment purposes, because DNA results, if you've ever done 23andMe or Ancestry or whatever, you'll know that they don't give you tribal results. It says that you're native. So it's not like people are receiving a 23andMe result that says you are Cherokee. They're receiving a result that says you are native. Where DNA testing comes into play is to determine who your parents are, right? And so mostly paternity testing. And so the people who are using DNA tests to become enrolled in tribes are using it as a paternity test to say, this person who is enrolled in this tribe is my biological father.
Okay. And Kendall asked if you can comment on the Ho-Chunk and the Meskwaki Sauk tribes.
So I'm not exactly sure, Kendall, what the question is. Maybe you can say a few more words about that.
Kendall, can you unmute and maybe?
Yes, I was just interested in knowing how the Ho-Chunk treat identity and how the Meskwaki and the Sauk. I know there are now two groups for the Meskwaki and Sauk, one in Nebraska, one in Kansas. But I was just curious if you had any additional information on those two tribes, on those groups.
You know, Kendall, I don't have any particular insight into the Ho-Chunk tribe. As you might imagine, with over 300 tribes, it would be difficult for any person to become an expert on all of them. But what I can tell you about the Meskwaki tribe that's kind of interesting and related to my book research is that the Meskwaki tribe is one of fewer than five tribes in the country who use a paternal enrollment process. And so what I mean by that is that in order to enroll in the Meskwaki tribe, it has to be, you have to be Meskwaki through your father. And so if you have a father who is non-native and a mother who is Meskwaki, you cannot formally enroll in the Meskwaki tribe. You then become a Meskwaki descendant. So that's sort of an interesting difference between Meskwaki and almost every other tribe in the country.
Thank you. So we have I think more of a comment too, but something very related to, I think probably this is the census, Denise. Back in the 1990s, when my children were very young, I discovered they were ticking the native box as they were born here and didn't realize the difference. So I did set them straight, but sure, some things were skewed for a bit. So does the word native?
You know, it's interesting that you bring this up, because no matter how you phrase the question, you get people who are confused. And so I can give you another example of this, which is when the question is asked of if you are American Indian, what ends up happening is you get a lot of people who are whose ancestry is from the country of India, who mistakenly check the box thinking that the question is asking if they are an American with Indian descent, if that makes sense. And so often you get that. When you ask the question in a different way, which is Native American, you get what I think Denise is probably referring to, which is people think that what the question is asking is if they were born in America, if they are native of the country of America. And so, you know, it's sort of six of one, half dozen of another. No matter what way you phrase the question, you end up having people who mistakenly check the box.
Okay. I think the next question here is from Catherine, and she's asking that you mentioned about your tribe not being recognized. Could you say more about this?
Sure. I am trying to, I don't see that question. So that must have just come to you. Yes. So the tribes that I quantified in the data set that you just saw, those are federally recognized tribes. What that means is those are tribes that the federal government has determined are Native American tribes and for whom the federal government gives support financially. They also are the tribes that the federal government has deemed sovereign in the sense that they can create their own laws and have a special relationship with the United States. There are many tribes in the country who do not have federal recognition. The Lumbee tribe, I believe, is the largest of those. The Lumbee tribe is actually the largest tribe east of the Mississippi River. For a lot of reasons has remained not federally recognized. There have been over 30 Senate bills to seek recognition over the last century. None of them have succeeded. The Lumbee actually had a special piece of legislation written for them called the Lumbee Act, where it was said by the US government that Lumbees are natives, but they will not receive recognition by the government, and therefore they don't receive that same level of federal aid. So the Lumbee are actually sort of an anomaly as it relates to recognition, but a lot of tribes in this country remain federally unrecognized. Now, some of those tribes are state recognized. And so that would be the Lumbee is recognized by the state of North Carolina. There are certainly other tribes, a lot up in the Northeast region that are state recognized, but not federally recognized.
Okay, so we have another question here from Alice. And she said, you may have addressed this earlier, but do you know what tribes would have resided over time and last resided in Eastern Iowa?
So I actually do know this because the University of Iowa has a program called the Iowa First Nations Program, where we support any student who comes from a tribe that has historically called Iowa home. There are 67 of those tribes in the country. And so 67 tribes across the country, primarily in the Plains and Midwest region, have historically called Iowa home. This is not what you asked, Alice, but I can tell you that students from those tribes receive in-state tuition to Iowa, and we have some other programming for them. So a lot of tribes at one point have called Iowa home. The Meskwaki tribe is the primary residential tribe here in Iowa, where they have a settlement, the difference being that they own their land, and so it is not a reservation. The Meskwaki has a settlement. It's up near Tama, if folks are familiar with the area, about, you know, an hour and a half away from us here in Iowa City. There are a few other tribes that have trust land in Iowa. And so they still own or have access to a piece of land, but the Meskwaki tribe is really our main tribe that we have that's fully centered here in the state.
And Carlos is asking, are you seeing differences in how people identify with their native ancestry in Canada, Mexico, and the US?
Yeah, that's a great question. I have not looked at all into Mexico or South and Central America, but I can tell you that in Canada, they're experiencing very similar issues as we are here in the US. In Canada, what they call First Nations communities are having a similar challenge of this idea of blood quantum and how we measure. And so I think that this is a problem that goes beyond the United States of America, certainly. And we can learn a lot from each other. Kim Tallbear, who I mentioned earlier, whose book Native American DNA is a fantastic starting place. She's actually a professor up in Canada. So a lot of the scholars that are looking at this kind of stuff are our neighbors to the north. So yeah.
I think Mode just made a comment here. He said, very interesting. So Melinda is asking, why are the Lumbees not federally recognized as a tribe? And also, does your book address the Lumbee heritage, your Lumbee heritage?
Yeah, so my book is, it's part memoir. So yes, it looks at my own heritage and my own tribe. And then I also do interviews with people from other tribes. I wish I could answer the question why they have not been federally recognized. People have posited different theories that I'll let you Google, but no, there really is no one reason why the Lumbees remain not federally recognized.
And the last question we have here is, okay, another one just came in. So what's the difference between the census and the enrollment or cards? That's from Kristen.
Kristen might need to give me a couple more words on this. Do you mean a Native Tribe census or the U.S. census?
Can you type that, Kristen?
Okay, sorry. This is Krista. I'm driving, so I was like having to figure out, like I had a stoplight where I could type that really quickly. So yeah, like I was curious, the census numbers, the U.S. census numbers have obviously, you know, significantly increased. Have the people who carry the cards that show the quantum blood, has that increased, or has enrollment increased to match that? Or is that increase in the census really people who are not claiming those other affiliations?
So Krista, you're asking a fantastic question that I wish I knew the answer to. One challenge, although I use the word challenge sort of liberally here, is that we don't have a lot of data sets on this stuff. Part of the reason is because Native tribes are sovereign entities. And so although I don't consider myself part of the federal government anymore, the federal government doesn't do a lot of data analysis for Native tribes for good reason. But what that does mean is that we don't have a lot of data on this kind of stuff. And so I wish that I had a historical sort of outlook that told us what the trends are of enrollment, but I don't. What I suspect is that enrollment has remained relatively stagnant, but that's just a guess.
And I think here's another very interesting question from Paul. Are measures of lineage or blood quantum used to determine how tribal resources are distributed to tribal members? And probably that's our last question.
Not that I've ever seen, Paul. If what you mean is, do people with higher levels of blood quantum receive more resources? I've not seen that. What does happen though is that tribes, their enrollment numbers are used to determine how much aid they receive from the federal government. So that's not a person-to-person comparison. That's a macro level. How many enrolled members do you have? And so when I talked earlier about the Navajo tribe becoming the largest tribe in the country, that was a big deal because that determines how much federal assistance you have. And in the time of COVID, with COVID resources going out the door, that became a huge advantage to the Navajo Nation in having those COVID dollars with the larger population.
Thank you so much again, Professor Just Bliss, and for the excellent presentation and response to the questions. So this was ICRFC's second program for the spring semester. Our next program, which is next week, Wednesday at noon, Central Time, of course, will feature speaker Dr. Sarah Glazer from the World Wildlife Fund, and she will speak on preventing future fish wars. So I hope that all of us who are here today would be able to come and join us for next week. Thank you so much for joining us today. And I wish to say that we are adjourned for this session.